I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
This is Joe Fryer in Los Angeles, where tonight protesters have taken to the streets, angry over the death of Ezell Ford, a 25-year-old black man shot and killed by LA police.
Now the lawsuit will be filed, and a protest is now planned in response to the New Year's Day deadly officer-involved shooting.
It has happened again. Just 9 days after the uproar in Ferguson, a grand jury in New York City has refused to indict yet another white police officer said to have killed an unarmed black man.
Why are so many of those killed by police young people of color?
The rate for black teenage males was just astronomical.
Young black males are at 21 times greater risk of being shot dead by police than their white counterparts. That's according to a report by ProPublica. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll hear from one of the reporters who came to that startling conclusion, as well as stories of family and community members who say that the justice system itself needs to be put on trial. At a demonstration in Oakland, California, the crowd chants the names of some of those killed by police in recent years. From Oscar Grant to Alan Bluford, the list goes on.
Justice for Jesse!
Justice for Jesse!
Justice for Andy!
Justice for Andy!
Aaron Campbell's name was added to that list in 2010. His is one of many stories of people killed at the hands of police in Portland, featured in the film Arresting Power, produced by Jody Darby, Julie Perini, and Aaron Yankee. The filmmakers pieced together the hours and minutes leading up to Campbell's death. And to warn you, the film includes recordings of the actual 911 calls made that day, which some listeners may find disturbing.
Aaron Campbell had a brother who was in the hospital, suffering from an illness and terminal with this illness. Aaron Campbell had been by the side of his brother all the way through this. On a day where he actually decided to get a little bit of rest, and he went home. In the midst of him going home from the hospital, they got a phone call that his brother had passed. Some of his family members around him were concerned about his condition and concerned about some of his behavior. And in not knowing who to call or to help or assist Aaron with some of his mental anguish that he was going through, they called the police.
Yes, I need for the police to go out and do a welfare check on my niece. Her boyfriend is real suicidal. He done already tried to kill himself, okay. And now we can't get no contact from her.
What's the address, please?
It's 125th and Sandy. It's the Sandy Terrace apartment. His brother just died this morning, so that's where his mind is.
Okay, and it's her boyfriend that's suicidal?
Yes, it's the older kid's dad. It's her two oldest kids' father. His name is Aaron Campbell.
I'm getting the police started while we're talking. What is his name?
Aaron Campbell.
And do you know his date of birth or how old he is?
I don't know, 25, 26. When he came back, when I was talking to her, she immediately got off the phone and texted me, was like, he's back, I gotta call you later. And I haven't heard from her since.
Okay. So he had a brother that died this morning?
Yes. Won't answer. I'm like, text her, like, I'm going to send the police if you don't call me, and she still has it.
Okay. All righty. We've got police on the way.
Okay.
And we should be there shortly, okay?
All right. Thank you so much.
911.
Yeah, can you dispatch a police officer over to Sandy and 130, I think that's 138.
Sandy and 138, what's going on?
My daughter's baby's dad is over there, supposedly.
Just at that intersection?
No, it's an apartment. One of my daughters just called me.
So what are they doing, fighting over there?
No, his younger brother died of a heart problem in the hospital, and he's supposed to be over there with a gun and waving the gun around.
Okay, we've already got a call up. Officers are en route.
Okay, so I'm on my way over there, too.
The police showed up on the scene, having communications with Aaron Campbell via phone and text messaging.
Yeah, 2558 is here. He's going to go up to 125 and Prescott. I want 674 to stage loud and clear. Thank you.
Hey, Volcano, this is Hughes. I moved up to that alcove we were pointing at earlier, but I'm back in the parking lot. I think I can see the bedroom window on that.
Copy.
Just so you know, I'm just going to break this one little light out with my app so you'll hear some noise.
Copy.
3607.
3607.
Yeah, just for all the officers standing by, we're going to be communicating through him with text. So just keep holding, be patient, thanks.
And ultimately, Aaron Campbell decided to come out with his hands up.
Subject walking out.
Compliant so far.
Compliant so far.
Upon the police seeing Aaron Campbell, there was a canine unit, apparently, a dog that was ordered to attack Aaron Campbell, and in the midst of Aaron Campbell trying to defend himself from the dog and get away from the dog, he was shot with beanbag rifles.
The beanbag rounds deployed.
Beanbag deployed.
Beanbag rounds deployed. Shots fired. Lethal force is down.
Shots fired.
3610, code 3 medical. This way, have a stage on Sandy.
They're already being started.
There was a discussion or talk about him having a weapon. Some of the family members apparently had reported that he had a weapon, and this was what was used as justification for Aaron's murder, is that we thought and that he was reaching for a weapon. This is a classic excuse or justification that's used by police officers in the Portland area, that they thought that someone was reaching for a weapon and then one ends up dead.
I'm George Lavender, and you're listening to a special radio adaptation of Arresting Power here on Making Contact. In the next excerpt from the film, we're going back more than three decades to another police shooting. The 1975 death of Ricky Johnson prompted widespread protests in Portland. Among those calling for change was Charlotte Williams of Portland State University Black Students Union.
We demand to know how an officer could feel his life is being threatened by someone who is obviously running away. Was it necessary to shoot Ricky in the head? Why not shoot to maim instead of to kill? Obviously, the officer was close enough to be able to get a clear shot. If the police were completely aware of the robbery attempt the Young brothers were allegedly planning, why didn't they simply surround the house and order all inside to come out? Where could they have gone? If they had come out shooting, we could understand retaliation by the police. But to have apparently set them up so that the situation was allowed to easily get out of hand and have a young life wasted was unnecessary on the part of the police.
Here's how local station KOIN reported the killing.
Ricky Johnson died after being shot by Portland Police Bureau patrolman Kenneth Sanford, who was disguised as a cab driver.
Ricky Johnson had been in a house, and there was some talk about him and some other young men who were setting up delivery people to rob them.
That's Joyce Harris, co-chair of the Black Justice Committee.
And later on, we found out that the police actually, they had ordered Chinese food. And the police actually rendezvoused with Radio Cab, and they actually met up with the delivery people from the Chinese restaurant, and the police put on the jacket and then went to the house. And apparently, Ricky came to the door. The police had their gun, his gun, our understanding was inside one of the fast food boxes. And when Ricky opened the door, the police dropped the box and had the gun. And Ricky turned and ran. And when he turned and ran, he was shot in the back of the head.
Baker is a child killer!
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 Members of Portland's Black community and the Portland State University Black Student Union expressed outrage at Johnson's death and the police slayings of four other minority people in the last 5 months. Spokespersons met with Police Chief Bruce Baker this morning, and the chants of demonstrators outside could be clearly heard in the conference room.
Fire Chief Baker! Fire Chief Baker! Fire!
After the conference, Baker said he will not expel Patrolman Sanford from the force.
Why not? Because it has not been our policy in the past, and it is not our policy now, and we will not be changing it at this time.
So people were outraged because we didn't understand why that had to happen. We had a meeting at the Black Educational Center to kind of strategize what were we going to do as a community. And one of the decisions was that we were going to protest and march around the Portland Police Bureau. As a community, we realized that we needed to organize to address this rash of police killings, because Ricky was just one of several who had been killed. I think in a 2-year period, 6 African-American men had been killed by Portland police. And so we organized this group called the Black Justice Committee, and I was the co-chair.
Another co-chair of the Black Justice Committee was Baruti Arthuri.
And this is more or less a situation in reverse, where we have the criminal telling the victim, it's okay. It's okay if I hit you on your head. It's okay if I shoot you in the back of your head. It's the criminal telling the victim this. And we as a community, if we're ever going to take a stand, the time now is to take a stand and to stop being victims and to stop reacting and start acting and speak up with the voice and the power that we have now before we won't even have that.
We'll be right back. This is Making Contact, and you're listening to excerpts from the documentary Arresting Power, a film by Jody Darby, Julie Perini, and Aaron Yankee. They have a lot more information about the film on their website, arrestingpower.com. We'll hear more from the film in just a moment. For more about this or past editions of Making Contact, check out our website at radioproject.org. Listen, like, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and most major podcast channels. And you can join the conversation online by liking us on Facebook or following us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
You're listening to Making Contact. I'm George Lavender. We've just heard about 2 cases of people killed by police in recent decades, but the investigative journalism outlet ProPublica set out to analyze the data on hundreds of such cases for signs of racial disparity. Their startling findings were released in the report Deadly Force in Black and White.
Just from looking at the raw numbers, the rate for black teenage males was just astronomical. Especially in the most recent years.
That's Ryan Gabrielson. In fact, he and his colleagues found that the risk of being killed by the police was 21 times greater for black males than their white counterparts. How did they get to that conclusion? It starts with something called the Supplementary Homicide Report.
A Supplementary Homicide Report is, in total, it's a database of all homicides known to law enforcement every single year.
And in those homicides is a subset categorized as felons killed by police.
And those are what law enforcement say are their justified homicides. And it's a woefully incomplete record set in that, you know, it maybe has probably half of all these homicides that actually take place in each year.
But despite the issues with the data, Gabrielson says it still shows something that many campaigners have said for years, that young black males are disproportionately killed by police. And it also tells us something about how the justification for those homicides has changed.
There was a really dramatic shift that started in the mid-1980s.
Up until then, Gabrielson says law enforcement gave all kinds of reasons as justification for killing someone.
A lot of times it was they caught the person in the commission of a crime. About a third of the time, though, it was, they said that the perpetrator or the felon, as they characterize it, was resisting or fleeing arrest.
But something happened that would change all that.
In 1985, the U.S. Supreme Court instituted sort of its first rules or limitations on when law enforcement can use deadly force.
The decision came in a case called Tennessee versus Garner. And those rules basically said that officers could not use deadly force unless the officer has probable cause to believe that their life or another person's life was at risk.
You know, it's still kind of wide open because it's a subjective assessment in which whether or not the law enforcement officer had, you know, cause in their own head to feel that their life was at risk. And so that's pretty wide latitude. But it was still, you know, saying, it basically said you can't shoot somebody purely because they're not complying with your commands to halt and be arrested.
And remember, up until 1985, that had been justification for killing a suspect.
And so you would have expected to see this drop off in homicides.
But Gabrielson says that's not what the data shows.
Instead of what we see is a change in how law enforcement justify them. Where suddenly, instead of being, you know, a huge number of these cases being described as, you know, the perpetrator was fleeing, the overwhelming majority are described as officer was being assaulted.
And that stands out in particular because
that would suggest that violent crime against officers was going through the roof at a time of historic drops in violent crime rates for every other category of the population. So you have to ask, is it a change in how police are describing the incidents, or is it a change in actual violence out there in the world? And I don't have the answer to that, but I think that's something that merits a great deal more scrutiny.
The ProPublica article, Deadly Force in Black and White, is online at propublica.org. Many thanks to Ryan Gabrielson for sharing his work with us. You're listening to Making Contact. While there are more stories of men shot dead by police, each year women and trans people are also killed, from 92-year-old Catherine Johnston to 7-year-old Ayanna Jones. In this next story from the film Arresting Power, we hear about a 2003 shooting in Portland that left a 21-year-old woman dead.
I work at Rose Haven, and I had found this really pretty blue dress, and I said, God, this would look really nice on her. I didn't know I was picking out her dress for her to be buried in.
Shirley Isidore's daughter, Kendra James, was killed by Portland police in 2003.
Kendra James was a young woman who was in an automobile that was stopped by the Portland police. And she wasn't driving, but the person who was in the car was detained, and then she moved over into the driver's seat and started to drive away. Officer Scott McAllister then fired into the car and killed her.
That's Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue.
The police later argued that because McAllister was trying to extract her from the car when she started moving, that she posed a threat to his life, and therefore the use of force was justified. The evidence does not really support the police theory on what happened there, although in practical terms, that made no difference in terms of whether McAllister was going to be disciplined or not. The thing that made it so that McAllister was disciplined was that there was a huge community outrage over this. The case was immediately understood as this exercise in racist violence.
This wasn't a murderer. That wasn't someone who was a danger to the community. This was someone that failed to show up for a court date. And that's why there was a warrant out for her.
Joanne Hardesty of the Albina Ministerial Alliance.
And so what she did was attempt to come over the back seat, and she was going to get in the driver's seat and drive off. The police officer then wrestled with her before he pulled his gun out and shot and killed her. I will also say that he was a 235-pound officer, and she weighed less than 100 pounds.
Kendra was the most bubbliest child you could ever imagine. She could be your best friend, she would be your best friend forever. She just wanted to have friends and just do life, you know, have fun as, you know, as teenagers do. She loved dancing. One year we went to MC Hammer. Her dad had bought her tickets to MC Hammer. She was 8. We got there, we were like second rows from the stage. She bought a flower, and when he started singing, she got up into this aisle and she danced her heart out. And it was so funny because when he got closer to the stage, she was able to run up and give him the rose, and he picked her up and put her on stage and let her dance her heart out. was the most amazingest thing you could ever imagine from somebody at 8. You know, she could never hurt anybody. It's just, you know, we go through life, we go through challenges, and we go through changes. You know, she got caught up into drugs, you know, and she was fighting at that time. And within those days, you know, she had called Sister Kathy at Rose Haven and said, "Sister Kathy, I'm ready to change my life so that I could be a better mom to my son." But she never got that opportunity to make it there. She was trying to make it to me, she just couldn't get there in time. And seeing the sadness of her sister, because they were the best of friends. She lost her best friend and her sister. And I lost my daughter, and she was my best friend.
Police union, of course, came to McAllister's defense, and that has been their historical institutional role throughout their existence.
Again, Christian Williams.
That in addition to bargaining for line officers in terms of things like, you know, wages and hours and workplace conditions and that sort of thing, they also are the last line of defense for things that are indefensible. And so when the police have engaged in the most clearly out of line, out of policy uses of violence, or the most egregious racist behavior, the Portland Police Association has been there to defend them, even when it's impossible for their commanders to defend them, even when it's impossible for politicians to defend them. McAllister was suspended for 6 months, but he was later reinstated and got the 6 months back pay.
We went to court for 8 days, and it took them 45 minutes to say he was not guilty. You know, those 8 days in court were gruesome. How come they're always the winners and we're always the losers? We fight for our rights and our rights still not being taken care of.
When all the saints of God's gathering home, we shall tell the story. How we overcome, and we'll understand it better by and by. By and by, when the morning comes, when all the saints of God's gathering home, we will tell.
From the Black United Front to the local activists today in Portland, the movie Arresting Power also chronicles responses to police shootings. In this final excerpt from the film, former Portland Black Panthers and current activists discuss the way forward for the movement to end police violence. And we hear first from R.L. Anderson, founder of Portland's Black Berets, at an Albina Citizens Council meeting in 1968.
Earlier today, all factions of our community and our different agencies got together and made a decision. that we simply will not allow the mayor, the city hall, or anybody else to continue to intimidate, to browbeat, and to threaten the security of Albina. Albina is independent in that it is not linked with any other community, and Albina is going to protect itself.
I did what you call grassroots organizing.
Kent Ford was founder of the Portland Black Panthers.
You know, like we was out in the field every morning with leaflets under my arms, you know what I mean? Pass them out to people, catch one, two, three people on the corner and talk to them about the war in Vietnam, racism at home, poverty at home and everything like that, you know. This is where I found my calling in life, you know what I mean? Yeah, this is where I found my calling in life.
The Black Panther Party, which was a national organization, started in Oakland in 1966, focused on doing for self for the community and the idea of community control for all oppressed communities, including working class white communities.
Walida Imarisha is author of The Oregon Black History Timeline.
And one of their first acts was to patrol the police to make sure that police weren't brutalizing and terrorizing the community.
When we stop somebody, we pull over, we ask the people that they pull over, what they're being stopped for, what they're being charged with, If they take him to jail, we said, don't worry, we'll be right down to get you out. And that's the kind of stuff we did.
There was a lot of police brutality going on in the black community. A lot of people were getting beaten up, and you know, there were some people that was getting killed, and it was necessary to address some of those issues.
That's Percy Hampton, distribution manager of the Portland Black Panthers.
And when you would go before, you know, the police station or the police department and try to address some of these conditions, you would get no satisfaction from it. We felt it necessary to start the Black Panther Party behind that. During the summer of 68, we had a riot around here behind the police brutality thing. The times were just kind of ripe for this to happen. I was involved with the selling and distributing of the Black Panther Party newspaper. I was also involved in the Black Breakfast Program. I was on the board of Breakfast and the Health and Dental Clinic. We also had sickle cell anemia testing. We started out here in Portland as NCCF, which is a National Committee to Combat Fascism. When we got involved in the party, there were so many chapters around. They wanted people to have their programs established before they would give them a chapter status. We gained our chapter status in the middle of 1969, and from there was the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense is organized now throughout the nation. We are recognized internationally, and we advocate that all black people in America are taught what politics is all about and what our history is all about so that we can have self-identity and we can know where our strength is, we will know our enemies, and we'll know our friends. This is a black curriculum.
Who brought me into the party the week after he got out of prison? He walked over to me. And he asked me, do we have any buildings? I said, yeah. We got a health clinic, we got a dental clinic, we got a breakfast program and stuff like that, you know. And a week later, he sent us a letter authorizing us as a chapter. We had our pulse on the community, you know. People respected us. We were sort of like a buffer between the community and the power to be downtown.
On the other side, the question became, well, if we don't have police, you know, we don't even have the illusion of this institutional way of dealing with harm, what do we do? And the Black Panther Party stepped into that role across this country because they were the organization that kind of stood up, and people came to them and said, all right, well, I'm having problems with, you know, intimate violence in my household. I'm having, you know, problems with this person who wants to, you know, attack me on the street. And the Black Panther Party really stepped into that role of saying, how do we figure this out? I don't think, you know, every historical example isn't perfect, and we certainly shouldn't just take it and replicate it and shove it on what we have today. But I think people have a problem even thinking outside of the box at all, thinking, what could a world look like without police? How could communities be safe and whole without police, without prisons, without these institutionalized criminal justice systems? And I think the Black Panther Party especially offers us an example that this is possible.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Throughout the show, we've heard excerpts from the film Arresting Power. For more information, go to arrestingpower.com. And you can check out our website at radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Quan Booth, Laura Flynn, Jasmine Lopez, Lisa Rudman, and Andrew Stelzer. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.